This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Canada was founded on the basis of ethnic cleansing, land theft, genocide, slavery, and imperialism. But the fact that most people think Canada was founded on good Christian values, peace, and good government suggests that Canada was, above all, founded on mass delusion and self-deception. Richard Sanders is the editor of Press for Conversion, the recently revived magazine from COAT, the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade. The latest issue is titled Captive Canada, Renditions of the Peaceable Kingdom at War, and features articles on Canada's imperial and racist past. Earlier this week, I had a chance to speak with Richard Sanders about what he calls the Canada Syndrome and the history of internment camps in the 20th century. To begin with, can you maybe give me a sort of a little bit of an outline of what we consider sort of the dominant mythology of Canada, what we think of as how the country was founded?
Right. Well, not just how we were founded, but the way we look at ourselves as Canadians, the attitude we have about Canada, how we, what our role is in the world, and our history and all that. Canadians do have this national narrative, a mythology about ourselves that we associate ourselves with beautiful words like peace and human rights and democracy and justice and multiculturalism. And a phrase that's often thrown around, which is part of the mythology, is Canadian values. So we often hear government tripe about, you know, wondrous Canadian values. We hear a lot about peacekeeping, the peacekeeping tradition, and Canada's role on the global stage as a promoter of justice and peace and human rights and all this sort of thing. So that is a major part of how Canadians see themselves. And we often juxtapose ourselves with the Americans, and a lot of Canadians look at the United States and Americans as being rude and as being kind of a warmongering country, which is true. But the reality is that Canada is a very strong part of that tradition as well, and we have a blind spot for our own role as imperialists and as warmongers and as violators of human rights and promoters of injustice and around the world, as well as within the boundaries, the borders of what we now call Canada.
What are some of the historical facts that underlie that your assertion that Canada is really more of a warmongering nation than we'd like to believe?
Well, from the earliest days of Europeans coming to this land, I mean, there were kidnappings and many examples of mass captivity and injustice and genocide against Aboriginal peoples. So that is the basic founding of Canada. Our nation is built on plundering land and on ethnic cleansing and cultural genocide. This has become more and more mainstream information now, what with the all the work done around truth and reconciliation around Aboriginals, and particularly with the residential schools. But somehow still there's a disconnect. People will recognize, oh yes, we did have those residential schools, but Canada is still a great multicultural country, and it's, you know, our history is one of peace and justice and human rights. And so the when people do have some knowledge about history, and I think that knowledge is growing. That's a good thing. But we have a long way to go to try to debunk this mythology that's such an important part of our identity as Canadians. We've been involved in so many different imperial wars for Britain and for the United States and NATO, and Canada is a major participant and a major player in the international arms trade. You know, we are among the top 10 or 12 weapons exporters in the world. Most Canadians probably don't know that. No other country in the world exports more military equipment to the United States than does Canada. So we export about $4 or $5 billion worth of military equipment to the U.S. every year. And that equipment, a lot of it goes into the manufacture of major weapon systems. So there are very few major U.S. weapon systems that that exist that don't have some very essential Canadian components in them, that if the Americans didn't have Canadian military production subsidized by the government, they wouldn't be able to fly their fighter planes and their bombers, and they wouldn't have the major weapon systems that they have. We're a major part in the U.S. war machine. Some examples, which should help to dismiss the mass psychosis that we have, this delusion of Canadian exceptionalism, you know, that Canada is this wonderful promoter of peace and a force for peace. I prefer to say that we're a farce for peace, and that we excel in hypocrisy and duplicity and complicity in imperialism, rather than as a great promoter of peace and multiculturalism and democracy around the world. We're actually we're really good at pretending, but in the reality is so much different from what we see it as.
The opening essay of your the revival of your magazine Press for Conversion talks about something called the Canada Syndrome. Is that what this Canada Syndrome is? Is this mass psychosis you were talking about?
Yeah, basically. I think it's, you know, Canada is not the only nation to have this kind of a syndrome. A lot of other countries have the same mass delusion that we have here in Canada. Particularly other countries like the United States and Australia, South Africa, Israel, they have all evolved to and developed the same sort of narrative identity myths that we have here in Canada. But I think Canada has a particularly sad case of this mass psychosis or the syndrome. And so it's, I think, okay or it's fair to call it a Canada syndrome. It doesn't mean that it's only restricted to Canada, in the same way that the Stockholm syndrome doesn't just afflict people who are kidnapped and held hostage and start to identify with their captors in Sweden, you know, or in Stockholm. You know, it's a syndrome that could be named after a place, Canada, but it's not necessarily at all restricted to people that live in Canada. And it's similar to the Stockholm syndrome in the sense that, well, whereas the Stockholm syndrome is when individuals are held captive and begin to believe the narratives or stories of their captors, the same thing happens on a mass cultural level or scale when people are held captive by their culture and by their institutions and the narratives and the lies and the myths that they are told from the time that they're born and throughout their entire lives, and they begin to identify with these institutions of the state and believe them and become advocates for the very delusions that are holding them captive.
Throughout the magazine, one of the dominant things or dominant areas you explore in quite a bit of detail is the notion of internment or separating one group of people from another. I'd like to spend a fair amount of time talking about that. Maybe you could start by giving us sort of the roots of internment, maybe going back to the original colonization of Canada, what, 500 years ago?
Yeah, well, when people hear about internment in reference to Canadian history, I think most people have some idea about internment camps that happened during the 20th century. They'll probably have heard about the Japanese internment camps, for example. There were also internment camps during the First World War, and the government called them at the time, they called them concentration camps, and they were forced labor camps. So they were slave labor camps, and about 8,000 young, mostly East European, mostly Ukrainian men from the cities who were unemployed. There was an economic crisis, a depression at the time, that started in 1913. And so when the First World War began in 1914, they used the war as a pretext for rounding up some 8,000 young men. And by it was no coincidence that the men that they rounded up were also the same people that the elites within Canada, the political and economic elites, feared were the most dangerous, threatening group, the most dangerous demographic within the country in terms of their being radicalized by socialists. They were very worried, the elite at the time was in Canada was very worried about a revolution or massive strikes and disruptions, and they took their World War One pretext and used it to as an excuse, basically, for rounding up all of these young men in the cities that were beginning to come into the cities because they had been laid off by the tens of thousands in the in these heavy labor-intensive jobs, working on railways, working in the bush, working in mines, and they began to come into the cities. So they were rounded up and put in these forced labor, slave labor camps. So that was during World War One, and then between the two world wars, there was also an internment camp program. They called it at the time, they called them relief camps, and it was during the Depression. So from 33 to 36, they rounded up, it was more than 100,000 people. They were either going to be sent to jail or they had to go to these relief camps. It was, again, it was young, unemployed, working class men in the cities. And the government at the time, in fact, it was the grandfather of a Liberal member of Parliament now, Andrew Leslie, his grandfather at the time was the general in the Canadian military, and he told the Prime Minister at the time that what they needed to do was round up these young men because they were the most dangerous threat to Canada because they were potentially going to be radicalized and organize revolts. They were very worried about communists and radical revolutionaries, so they actually explicitly said, and this is revealed in memos and letters and government documents that have since been released through Access to Information, that they were really worried about these revolutionaries, and so they produced these relief camps, so-called relief camps, and put hundreds of, you know, more than 100,000 people into these camps, where again they were forced to do, they were forced labor camps. And there were strikes of all kinds, hundreds of strikes within those forced labor camps. Then, of course, there's the Second World War internment camps that people know about, the Japanese, but also pacifists were rounded up, communists were rounded up, Germans, other nationalities. Now, some of them were indeed fascists or Nazis that were put into these camps, but a lot of them weren't. There were the Japanese; there were no threat at all. It was an extremely racist program. And also, when Canada during the Second World War had a no Jews policy, the Canadian government, the Liberal government then, didn't want any Jewish immigrants. And people came, were fleeing from fascism in Europe, came in a big boat. There's a famous case of the boat that came, and they were turned away by a Canadian military. But also during the Second World War, when Britain had all these refugees in its camps, mixed in with Nazis that they were holding in Britain, they decided that they needed to get rid of them because it was just too much of a burden on Britain. So they sent them mostly to Canada, but also to Australia. And when they got here, thousands of these people that were sent over by Britain, who were supposed to be dangerous war prisoners, ended up being Jewish. They were refugees from Europe that had fled to Britain. And they had been put in these camps, and then they were sent to Canada. Well, Canada didn't want them because they were Jews, and Canada was the Liberal government was extremely racist against Jews, and it kept them in prison camps. We had Jewish prison camps in Canada during Second World War. Now, how many people know about that? There were, I think, almost 2,000. Communists and Jews, mostly Jews, that were put into these camps. They were refugees from Europe. Now, a fourth internment camp program during the 20th century, and then you'll may have to remind me to get back to the precedent for it, which was pre-20th century. But finally, from the Second World War, all through the Cold War, right up until the 1980s, there was another internment camp program called Profunk. And every year, the RCMP would put together a list of 1,000 or 2,000 people that it was going to round up and put into internment camps in the event that there was a war, or not only just a war, but also any kind of a vaguely described civil disturbance or social disorder. Then they would round up these people, and they were mostly communists, but not all communists. So they had a list of 40,000 or 50,000 subversives at the time that they were going to monitor and surveil all through the Cold War up until the 1980s, and about 1,000 or 2,000 of those were going to be put into internment camps in the case of some kind of a national emergency or civil disorder. So that existed right up until the 1980s, and it's not clear that the program was ever really destroyed. It may have just had its name changed into something else. So those are the four major internment camp programs that happened during the 20th century. But the precedent for all of this was the mass captivity of Aboriginal people on reservations. They were forced onto reservations starting in a really intense way in the 1880s and in the prairies. And this was a major part of the cultural genocide of Aboriginal people. It wasn't just forcing them into the captivity of residential schools and kidnapping kids and taking them away from their parents and from their communities, but dividing the communities up and forcing people to stay on reservations. If they were found off reservation, then they would be put into jail. You needed a permission from the government to leave your reservation. And so you couldn't trade with other people from a different reservation. You couldn't go and visit. You couldn't go to social, cultural, religious ceremonies that were held off your reservation. You couldn't hunt off your reservation. You couldn't gather materials off your reservation. So it was led to, it was part of a cultural genocide. It was also a physical kind of a genocide, and lots of people died of starvation. The government, Johnny McDonald's government, kept Aboriginal people on the verge of starvation on these reservations, and it's part of our heritage and a dark history of Canada that I don't think enough people know about. There is a long history of mass captivity in Canada, and much of it most Canadians probably don't have really much of a clue about.
Along with the physical actions of actually rounding up people, putting them into camps, along with that generally has to go come some sort of narrative or justification. I'd like to talk a bit about that. And in particular, yeah, one of the most fascinating figures in your magazine is the Woodsworth family. And can you tell me a little bit about who James Woodsworth was?
Sure. J.S. Woodsworth, many people are still in the progressive movement are still raised to revere him as a great leader. He was the first president or leader of the CCF, the forerunner of the NDP. He was a social gospel leader. He was a Methodist minister. The Methodist Church was the main church that came together with other churches to form the United Church of Canada in the 1920s. But J.S. Woodsworth is still highly revered as a great social democratic leader. You know, all my parents were peace activists, and I was raised in a family to think very highly of J.S. Woodsworth. I only ever heard positive things about the social gospel, which was this progressive movement within the churches. But in doing this research, I've had to really reconsider and actually discard many of the beliefs that I held in my own mind, in my own life, these attitudes that I had, these positive attitudes that I had towards J.S. Woodsworth and the social gospel really did not fare well in when I did the research into Canadian history. I found that J.S. Woodsworth was extremely racist. He was xenophobic, fearful of anyone foreign, and had an incredible ethno and he believed, for example, that Aboriginal people were, like his father did, and his father and generations going back on both sides of his family that I looked into, they all had this very, you could almost, well, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that they were white supremacists, you know. It was, the idea was to Canadianize, civilize, and to help to educate. These are the words that they use. You know, they were Christianizing and civilizing the Aboriginal people, who they called heathens and savages. They were inferior. And so J.S. Woodsworth, this great hero, he wrote this book several years before World War I, that it was called Strangers Within Our Gates. And within that book, he basically packed as many racist, xenophobic comments as he could about every group of people on earth, basically, that weren't Anglo-Protestant, white, British. And even them, he was very classist as well, so he made disparaging remarks against poor people, working class people. So he was a racist, xenophobic, classist, elitist, who was bound and determined to educate and civilize these poor heathens and lower forms of life and lower classes. And, you know, he made bad, disparaging remarks against blacks and against, talked about the Oriental problem, the Chinamen and Middle Easterners and Syrians and every kind of ethnic group in the world basically came under his scrutiny and were criticized on a kind of eugenist imperial basis of judgments against them. And probably the most feared group were East Europeans, because he associated them with this radical socialist, atheist ideology that he despised. And through his entire life, he was very strongly captured by this fear of Reds, of communists, and did his best to purge the CCF of any kind of radical socialists. So he was all for cooperation, but with the elite. He was very happy to cooperate with the elites, with business and with government, but he would not have any cooperation with radical socialists. And yet we think of J.S. Woodsworth now as a leader of socialist movement in Canada, a social democratic movement, but he was in fact very bound by his cultural programming to be very strongly anti-communist and anti-red, and to despise atheists and heathens. And so it was very sad to read this history and to find out that one of my heroes was actually not all he was cracked up to be.
That brings up a good point. I think we're taught from almost infancy that what we should do is we need to defer to authority, whether it's our parents or our teachers or the local priest if you go to church, or our political leaders. How, I'm wondering if you have any remarks or advice on how we can break free from that indoctrination. You know, how should we approach our study of Canadian history if we want to get to look beyond the dominant narrative?
Well, that's a good question. It's a broad, very difficult problem that everyone faces. We all have to take a good, close look at what our narratives are, what our beliefs are, what our ideologies. Everybody has to engage in a kind of truth and reconciliation movement. You know, not right that we just point the finger at somebody else and say, those guys over there, they really have to look at their beliefs and reevaluate them, and etc. I really strongly believe that progressives, lefties, good, well-meaning activist types really need to look at our own complicity and our own narratives and how it's possible that in what are we doing now, we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing now that in 100 years they're going to look back at, back on, and say, what were they thinking? How could they have done that? There are examples that I see in the peace movement that I've come across over the three decades that I've been, working full-time as a peace activist. I'm constantly, over these decades, I've been encountering other people in the peace movement, and I strongly identify with the peace movement, and the anti-war movement. That's a big part of my self-identity. But I've been very critical over the years of different ways in which peace and human rights and development organizations have actually bought into the mainstream narratives on certain topics, like, for example, with the coup in Haiti in 2004, there was the democratically elected government of Haiti was overthrown. The United States, France, and Canada invaded, occupied the country, kicked out the democratically elected government there, and imposed a dictatorship that was brutal. And this was done in large part with the help of government-funded, not supposedly non-governmental organizations, peace groups, development groups, human rights groups. And the same sort of thing happens quite often, where you have progressive people who believe the official narrative on a certain topic. The mainstream media is promoting a certain narrative, and the government's promoting that narrative, and the mainstream peace, human rights, development groups can get suckered into it and actually become the best spokespeople for the narrative. So it's not just that, you've got these right-wingers that are tricking us with propaganda and we fall for it. It's not really that so much as progressive people themselves become the best marketers and the best creators of this, of these false narratives, because they're, they are more effective at conveying the myths and pulling along the mainstream public. And because they actually believe the myths, they believe the myth that Canada is a great peacekeeper, et cetera, et cetera. So who better to spread that myth and to say, we're bringing democracy to the poor people of Haiti by overthrowing this government that they have there, and we know best for what they should have, and we are more advanced than they are, so we're more able to see that we need to invade, kick out the government, put in another government. So the same thing happens with the so-called responsibility to protect doctrine that the United Nations has, which is basically a kind of institutionalization of the creation of narratives that can be used to sell wars to the public, to convince them that they need to go to war to protect people from some dictator or something, So we can't trust. We have to be more cynical and less trustworthy and not just accept on faith what we're hearing in the mainstream media and what we're hearing from our government. So when they tell us, we should invade country X because we need to help those poor people in country X, we have to be very, very wary about that, because do we really trust the United States and Britain and France and Canada and NATO when they tell us that we need to do an invasion of Libya or Syria or whatever, or Haiti or Iran or wherever? They build up an enemy, a group of people, foreigners, as an enemy. We have to be so skeptical of it. And the progressive movement itself, peace, human rights, development groups, are not immune from being caught in the mainstream, in believing in these mainstream narratives and becoming promoters of the mainstream narratives. So I guess, in short, we need to be more skeptical and more cynical about the narratives that are constantly bombarding us from the mainstream media and from the government and from progressive organizations.
That was Richard Sanders from COAT, the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade. He's also the editor of Press for Conversion, the newly revived magazine published by COAT. To learn more about Press for Conversion, as well as purchase copies or subscriptions, please visit the COAT website, which is coat.ncf.ca.